Welcome back to another episode of New Books in African American Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James West, and joining me today is Ita Mikaeli to talk about his new book, The Defender. Ita's book is a 600-page epic which charts the long and compelling history of the Chicago Defender, one of the most influential black periodicals of the 20th century. Drawing on dozens of interviews and extensive archival research, Ita documents the impact of publisher Robert S. Abbott, columnists such as Ida B. Wells and Langston Hughes, and hundreds of other journalists and editors who contributed to the legendary newspaper's development. Ita Mikaeli is an award-winning author, publisher, and journalist based in Chicago. During the 1990s, he worked as a copy editor and investigative reporter for the Chicago Defender. He is currently the executive director of We the People Media and is also working on a new book project.
So joining me now is Ita Mikaeli. How are you doing today, Ita?
I'm doing great, James.
Okay, good stuff. So we're going to talk about your new book today, The Defender, an incredibly dense, incredibly rich history of the Chicago Defender over, I think, nearly 640 pages long. It's obviously kind of this work of love. So before we get into that, let's just talk a little bit about yourself so our listeners have a chance to find out a little bit more about you. So if you could say what your background is and how you came to write this book.
Sure. So I was raised in Rochester, New York, which is a town in upstate New York, some hours away from New York City, closer to Buffalo on Lake Ontario. And I originally came to Chicago as a student at the University of Chicago. I graduated in 1989 with a degree in English and came to work at the Chicago Defender newspaper shortly thereafter, first as a copy editor and later as an investigative reporter. Your listeners should also know that I'm a white Jewish guy, and of course the Defender is the historic African-American owned newspaper in the city. I have to be honest that I didn't know anything about the Defender or its storied role in the city, or really about race in America, which I honestly thought was an issue which had been largely dealt with in the civil rights era.
So you start working, when do you start working for the Defender, and how long is it that you're working there before you leave?
So I worked at the Defender from 1991 to 1996. I was a copy editor there for about the first 18 months. And then I spent the balance of the time as an investigative reporter, focusing largely on police issues and public housing. And I left the Defender in 1996 to start a magazine called The Residents Journal, which was a magazine written for and by public housing residents in the city. Public housing in Chicago, your listeners may or may not know, was largely a system of high-rise developments in different parts of the city. The overwhelming majority of the residents were African American, although it was quite a diverse population as well. Even though the majority of the residents were African American, the public housing population included significant numbers of other folks. So I retained a connection both with the African American community and with the people that I worked with at the Defender during my time at the Residents Journal. And I actually just left the Residents Journal or shut down the Residents Journal. It was a nonprofit organization that we started to run it. And I shut that down last summer, just as the Defender book was about to come out. So there is a connection between all these things.
How long has this book been kind of circulating in your mind as a project, and how long has it kind of taken to actually write it, if you can put a time frame on it?
Yeah, so ever since I worked at the Defender, which for me was really a transformative experience, I felt that the newspaper deserved a book. I was really awakened to the realities of race in America and the pivotal role that African Americans in Chicago had played in American politics and in American culture as well, through my time at the Defender. And I just felt very strongly that it needed some sort of book. It took many years until I found an agent and then later a publisher who would believe in this idea. And I have to say that the election of President Obama in 2008 was the moment in which the significance of Chicago's political enterprise within the African American community became apparent to everybody. So it was something that helped me get the book out as well. So it took a long time for this idea to gestate as a pure history of the newspaper. There had never been a comprehensive history of the Chicago Defender before, although there had been memoirs written by former staffers, and there had been a biography of Robert Abbott, the founder of the Defender, going back to 1955. So there was quite a bit of academic work as well on the newspaper, but there had never been a comprehensive history of the newspaper. And in the end, I really felt that that was what would be the best way to convey the experience that I'd had in re-understanding or in understanding the truth about American race relations.
And just before we start talking specifically about the Defender, if you could just say a little bit about your use of sources. So you've obviously drawn very heavily on archival sources, whether that's at Vivian Harsh or other Chicago Public Library or other collections, and then also extensive interviews with both former and continuing staffers. So if you could just say a little bit about both your use of archives and then your use of interview as and how you kind of use those two sources within the text.
Yeah, so the archives, the Abbott-Sengstack family archives, which is a larger collection, I'm told, than the equivalent archives of the Hearst or Pulitzer families, are, as you say, located at the Vivian Harsh collection in the Carter G. Woodson Regional Library on 95th Street in Halsted in Chicago. It is a beautiful library, but I have to say it's a resource that's really underappreciated both within the city and in the United States generally. To me, it is an amazing treasure trove of which the Abbott-Sengstack family archives are a crown jewel. And they are, I have to say, lovingly cared for by the archivists there, who have really just a bare bones reading room to offer researchers. But it is a place that really transforms into a magical location when you're able to sit there and access the incredible items that they have there, not just the Abbott-Sengstack family archives, but many other collections that they have, which are just absolutely incredible. As you say, I also did interview many former Defender staffers from the era that I from the time I worked at the Defender, as well as from other eras. And that was great. Some of them have since passed away, very sadly. Charles Davis, who was whose era really goes back almost to Robert Abbott's time, passed away at the age of 96, I believe. And Bob McClory, white man who left, who became a Defender staffer shortly after he left the priesthood, and had a very interesting experience and time there. Both Charles Davis and Bob McClory have sadly passed away since I interviewed them. So I feel very privileged to have those memories and to have included them in the book that way. They, of course, you know, those interviews both gave me priceless perspective on various moments and issues at the newspaper.
You mentioned there Robert Abbott,
Yeah.
who really is kind of the id of the paper, and he is the founder. Let's talk a little bit about Abbott. So, if you can give listeners a sense of his background prior to starting the Defender, and then his reasons for wanting to start this newspaper in the kind of early 20th century.
Yeah, well, Robert Abbott is really someone with a remarkable background, someone who, not of great wealth or from a prominent family, but with currents of culture and history running through his veins and his life that really propelled him in quite amazing directions and quite an amazing distance. He was born just after the Civil War on one of the islands off the coast of the Carolinas, which has a culture very, very closely connected to the African culture, one that was not completely severed by the horrors of slavery. And he was born to a woman who married into the Abbott family. Robert Abbott's mother was really had very little support from the Abbott family, actually. And Robert Abbott's biological father died. He may not have even ever seen his son. And he died definitely before Robert Abbott was 1 year old. But Robert Abbott's mother then went to the mainland and married a man with really a remarkable background. He was a man of both African and German heritage, whose father had been a German sailor and whose mother had been a slave purchased by this German sailor. This man, the Reverend Sengstack, or the future Reverend Sengstack, had been raised in Germany. His father, the sailor, had raised him in Germany to keep his son away from perhaps becoming a slave or from the horrors of what was just average conditions for people of mixed race in the American South at that time. But Mr. Sengstack, Herr Sengstack, came to the South to after the Civil War. The sailor, his German father, had died during the Civil War, and the son came to investigate what had become of his father's property. And during this time, he met Robert Abbott's mother and fell in love, and adopted Robert Abbott as his son. And treated him really not just as his son, but as a child who was prized for his intellect and ability and ambition, all characteristics which, when cultivated by this man who became a minister, a Congregationalist minister, and went by Reverend Sengstack afterwards, the Reverend Sengstack really cultivated these qualities in young Robert Abbott, and they would really give him a reserve of confidence that he would carry with him his whole life, which was very important because Robert Abbott was short, he was roly-poly, and he had a dark complexion at a time that complexion was important even to other African Americans. So in other words, here's someone from a background of rural poverty. He's raised in Savannah, in the outskirts of Savannah, Georgia, and he has a dark complexion. He's short and kind of pudgy. There are a lot of reasons for him to be overlooked, but it's his force of personality that propels him through life. And Robert Abbott goes to Hampton Institute. He basically writes his own, writes this very beautiful letter to the director of Hampton, and in which he basically, a single run-on sentence in which he says, "I will come and I would like to come and be a student at your university, and I will do anything to get there, and I will work my way through. I will do anything to be a part of your university." Very moving letter written in beautiful penmanship, a single run-on sentence, beautiful script. And Robert Abbott comes to the Hampton Institute, which is then, as it is now, one of the premier African-American educational institutions. This is the alma mater of Booker T. Washington, who was just a few years ahead of Robert Abbott, and many other intellectual luminaries. And Robert Abbott, as he arrives at Hampton, receives a prize position because he has this beautiful tenor voice and a musical ability that has been trained by his Gullah relatives in the Sea Islands, as well as the folks in Savannah. He's got just these beautiful musical traditions really directly from Africa that take him into the Hampton Quartet. And as a member of the Hampton Quartet, he's able to travel. This is, of course, before the era of recorded music and before the era of amplified music, even. So Robert Abbott is traveling the country and is immensely popular. He's offered a scholarship by Walter Domrosch in New York City. Walter Domrosch would go on to found Juilliard. He's in Chicago. He's part of the 1893 World's Fair. Now, this is a great position of honor where the Hampton Quartet is allowed to perform on the White City in the fairgrounds. Even very talented musicians like Scott Joplin and W.C. Handy are not able to find any venues to perform in Chicago. But Abbott has special access to the World's Fair, and he's able to be a part of not just the festivities and not just the great conclave of people from all over the world, but even more significantly, he's part of a gathering of African-American intellectuals, a whole new generation of activists and attorneys and young politicians and poets who are there under the auspices of Frederick Douglass, the great emancipator, friend of the great emancipator Abraham Lincoln, the escaped slave himself, who's 75 years old and still vital, still the spokesperson, the preeminent spokesperson for African Americans. And he's the master of the Haitian Pavilion at the World's Fair. And he gathers together all these young future leaders, James Weldon Johnson, who goes on to lead the NAACP. Ida B. Wells, the investigative reporter, is a mentee of his. Paul Lawrence Dunbar does a reading that's been commissioned by Frederick Douglass. He would go on to become the first nationally known African-American poet. And Robert Abbott is there, too, as this young singer, as a student at Hampton. And he's deeply influenced by Frederick Douglass, by the people that he meets, and by Chicago, which he sees has this history as a place to strike back against Jim Crow. It's a place where that had been known as a sinkhole of abolition before the Civil War. So it's got a history of resistance to racism and segregation and being a base for African Americans. It takes Robert Abbott some years to make it to Chicago, even after the World's Fair, and he still has a very tough time for a number of years, even after founding the Chicago Defender. At Hampton, he'd really learned the printing trade, but the unions in Chicago discriminated, so it was quite difficult for him to make ends meet. And even he went to law school. He graduated the only African-American in his class. But here his complexion, his Georgia accent, and his general appearance worked against him practicing as an attorney. So he really went hungry and impoverished for years. and then landed on the idea of launching a newspaper to strike back against the South and Jim Crow, but here too faced a lot of resistance because he was trying to use modern newspaper techniques, doing things like use headlines and dividing sections up into news and features and editorial and sports and children's section, women's section, sections. All of these were new innovations at a time that newspapers were really just pages with columns headlines that were all the same size and stories arranged for their ability to fit on the page rather than some sort of thematic order. So Abbott was doing these very remarkable things, and people did not catch on right away and actually saw his efforts to get readers as somewhat gauche. And it took a number of years before the newspaper really caught on. And when it did, it really caught on not just with the African-American community in Chicago, but with African-Americans around the country. And this was because Robert Abbott, his vision for a modern newspaper was something that inspired first a man named Frank Fay Young, who was a dining car porter, a dining car waiter, a man who worked on the train lines and collected newspapers from all the trains that he worked on, brought those papers. Fay Young had ambitions to become a journalist, and he met Robert Abbott, was inspired by Robert Abbott's vision, and brought newspapers back to the Defender's office, which I should say at this time was really Robert Abbott's landlady's dining room. Robert Abbott could not afford to have an office in the early years of the Defender, which we're now talking about 1905 was when he started the newspaper. And so 12 years after the World's Fair. And here, even though he couldn't afford an office, his landlady, Mrs. Henrietta Lee, adored Robert Abbott, believed in his vision, and volunteered her dining room as the Defender's first newsroom. And her apartment would stay the Defender's newsroom for the first 20 years of the newspaper's existence. And Frank Fay Young, the dining car waiter, brought newspapers back to this dining room where he and Robert Abbott would cut out articles, which would then become, they would rewrite from an African-American perspective. This was their wire service. Fay Young would then went back out onto the rails where he talked to his fellow porters and train workers about this newspaper that he was working for, convinced them not just to contribute articles themselves, but also to help distribute the newspaper by selling subscriptions and by finding distributors all over the country. So it was really in this kind of organic grassroots way that the Defender, by, let's say, 1912, had become a national communications vehicle for African Americans. And it was the fearlessness with which Robert Abbott went after lynching and other kinds of racist atrocities in the South that earned Robert Abbott and the Defender this great reputation, which continued to increase the newspaper's circulation and built up the newspaper's credibility until we get to the era of the Great Migration.
So let's talk about the Defender's role in the Great Migration.
Sure.
And you kind of expand on the argument that previous writers have made, which is essentially a kind of reciprocal argument where you have the Defender, the influence of the Defender, particularly in the South, kind of catalyzing that shift and that incredible expansion of the African-American population within Chicago, which in turn bolsters the Defender's own standing and own reputation as kind of the world's greatest weekly.
Yeah. So Robert Abbott did not initially support the Great Migration or migration from the South to the North. World War I radically changed the scenario for employment in the United States. The number of immigrants coming to the United States from Europe dried up, of course. Some immigrants even returned to Austro-Hungary, Russia, France or England, or other countries involved in the conflict. from the United States. So there was even a loss of people from the labor pool. African Americans then were the only workers available for what was an increasing demand at the same time for American manufactured goods and foodstuffs, which were exactly what Chicago specialized in. That said, Robert Abbott, even though unions and employers lowered their barriers and were anxious to have African-American workers, Robert Abbott didn't see the point of coming to Chicago when there were jobs available in Atlanta and Birmingham just the same. What changed his mind was when he saw that in one report, stevedores in the port of Jacksonville, Florida, disappeared en masse from the port in Jacksonville overnight. They'd been recruited to go work at a port in New Jersey, in Newark, and where wages were better and conditions were better. And with the support of their families, they decided to leave. But fearing what the response would be of their employers, they decided to all leave at once and in secret. And when that happened, suddenly the port in Jacksonville was imperiled. The managers of the stevedores, the white managers of the stevedores, who were all African American, did not have the same skill set, and they were not able to either do the work themselves or quickly train a new staff to replace them. So when Robert Abbott saw this, that's when he realized — this is the summer of 1916, fall of 1916. That's when Robert Abbott realized that the migration could hurt the Jim Crow South. When he saw that Southern newspapers, which until that point had really been a propaganda vehicle to maintain segregation — I mean, they had — the Defender was in many ways born as an antidote to that kind of propaganda, in that they, the Southern white owned newspapers, tended to create implausible excuses for various atrocities, such as lynching. In many cases, Southern newspapers abetted lynching directly, such as printing directions and times for their readers, saying, in other words, there will be a lynching at this location at this time, don't be late. So Robert Abbott, in many ways, was responding to Southern newspapers throughout his efforts at the Defender. And when he saw that these Southern white newspapers, who had just a few years earlier been calling for the expulsion of African Americans, or, as I said, been justifying various atrocities against African Americans, now are suddenly demanding that African Americans be treated well, and are starting to be introspective in terms of the way that African Americans have been mistreated in the South — Robert Abbott was number one, he was greatly entertained, but he was also very much anxious to use this situation in which the best workers of the South were departing from and leaving the South in a very bad situation. He was anxious to use this to the advantage of African Americans, essentially as leverage to bargain for better treatment from the South. So that shifted the Defender's line editorially. In terms of the news coverage, the news pages always reported accurately on conditions within Chicago as they did in the South. So that when the Defender reported on, for example, efforts to segregate Chicago's schools — Chicago's schools were not segregated initially, but the Defender, the Chicago Tribune had made some efforts to support people that wanted the schools in Chicago to be segregated — the Defender took on the Tribune as well as those people that wanted the Chicago schools to be segregated, and printed those. And so that the challenging of the people who wanted segregation took place on the editorial page, whereas the reporting on these efforts that they were taking place took place on the news pages. And similarly, the atrocities that were taking place in the South would be reported on in the news pages, whereas the editorial page would say, this is terrible, and we demand that the federal government and other appropriate agencies take action. So in that sense, when the Defender began to report began to shift its editorial line to say people should come to the North because it will strike back against the Jim Crow system. The readers believed the newspaper and trusted the newspaper because the newspaper wasn't sugarcoating the realities of life in Chicago on the news pages. You see what I'm saying? That there was this very deliberate effort to provide accurate information on the one hand, but say that regardless of how tough it is, there is a distinct advantage in a political sense to the migration to Chicago as well, and it, that trust that existed with the newspaper was essential to that first wave of the Great Migration. Chicago's population, African American population, doubled during the last few years of World War I, from around 50,000 to around 100,000. And many more tens of thousands of African Americans came through Chicago as a result of the Defender to create African American communities in other parts of the Midwest, everywhere from Milwaukee to Detroit to Rockford, Illinois. All of these communities, Gary, Indiana, and many, many others have African American communities because of the Defender's role in creating that first wave of the Great Migration to Chicago and the Midwest.
And that that sense of building community from the Defender came not just editorially, but also through endeavors such as the Billiken Club or the Parade. So if you could say a little bit about what Abbott intended to do with the Bud Billiken Parade and picnic, and how that was kind of either an extension or a kind of supplement to the editorial ambitions of the Defender.
Sure. As the migrants came to Chicago, Robert Abbott felt responsible for them as a civic leader, as well as the publisher of the newspaper, which had attracted many of them. So he worked with other African American leaders to begin to create institutions. Now, this is a situation in which other communities, immigrant communities, largely had resources, some of them public resources, that were being deployed. But African Americans were more or less left to their own devices and those institutions which they could create themselves. So as the Urban League and other groups begin to form to help the migrants find housing and find employment and get adjusted generally to city life, Robert Abbott is also thinking through what he can do for the migrants, and in particular for the children, who many of the young people don't have, as I mentioned, much in the way of recreational activities or much outside of the public school system, which has itself got its deficits. Robert Abbott is thinking how he can create some services and opportunities for them as well. He knows many young people himself because he employs them as newsboys for the Defender, and newsboys and newsgirls too. And he begins to appeal to them, of course, at first through the newspaper, through the Billiken page of the newspaper, which is a the Billiken. There's a lot of stories about what the Billiken, how it began, but the Billiken really was a curio that was manufactured in the United States, a kind of good luck charm, like a Cupid doll that originated in the early years of the 20th century, and then kind of faded from, you know, like, I don't know, your listeners might have, like, I've heard of a Pet Rock or a, what would be more current, like a Chia Pet or a, there are various kind of curio good luck charms that were very popular at that time. And the Billiken was one of them. It faded kind of from public from popularity by the 1920s, but there were still many of them around. And one day, Robert Abbott's editor plucked one of these from an editor's desk, thinking of how to create a children's section for the newspaper. And Bud Billiken, a character, was born. And shortly after that, Robert Abbott conceived of various activities that could support the Billiken page in the newspaper, which is becoming very popular. They started doing parades and activities. At first, this was done during the wintertime, which did not end up being a great idea given Chicago's harsh winters. And eventually they settled on doing an annual Billiken parade in August in Chicago, a back to school parade, which became immensely popular and which continues today. And it's a parade that has attracted African American celebrities and luminaries, and very importantly, political leaders, both white and black, who understand that Chicago's African American electorate is an essential component of a victory when it comes to politics, not just in Illinois, but as Illinois is often the key to a national coalition. So it's been the Billiken Parade has been a venue for politicians to reach out to this crucial electorate now for decades and decades.
So by the 1930s, the Defender is established itself as one of, if not the most important or certainly most popular black newspaper in the country. But by this point, Robert Abbott, he's not a young man anymore. By the 30s, he's into his early 60s. So is he thinking about retirement? Is he planning for his successor? Is he still active in the kind of day-to-day running of the newspaper? How does his role change, if it does change, in the lead up to his death in 1940?
Well, he is definitely beginning. Robert Abbott's health has been in sharp decline since his 50s, with a liver ailment that today would be treated fairly easily, known as Bright's disease, although it's really a constellation of liver ailments, as is the way that it would be looked at today, all of which are treated fairly easily or regularly. So Robert Abbott's health is in decline at the time. He is also very loyal and feels very much as the patriarch of the large Sengstack family, of which is descended from his mother and the Reverend Sengstack. The Reverend Sengstack and his mother had 8 children, and there are many descendants from that line. And Robert Abbott is and they're mainly in Georgia at this time. And Robert Abbott has become wealthy and powerful with the growth of the newspaper. And I mean, he's sought after by Republican presidential candidates regularly. He feels like he really must use this power and influence to bring up his entire family. And in some cases, literally bring them up from Georgia to Chicago. One of the young men in the family is the most promising of the descendants as a potential successor is a young man named John Sengstack, who is a student at Hampton in the early 1930s, graduates from Hampton in 1934. Comes to Chicago and finds that Robert Abbott is ill and has turned over much of his authority at the newspaper to his attorney, a man named Nathan McGill. And John Sengstack discovers that Nathan McGill has not been handling the finances properly at the newspaper, and he intervenes. and kind of seizes control of the newspaper at this young age and begins with the help of his uncle at this moment, although Robert Abbott, his health continues to decline throughout the 30s, and John Sengstack is increasingly taking over the newspaper, so that in 1940, when Robert Abbott dies, it's John Sengstack at the tender age of 28 who takes over. He is fought for control of the newspaper by Robert Abbott's widow and her allies. And it takes him a good year and a half to re-secure control of the newspaper legally. There's an entertaining or a moment of crisis in which Robert Abbott, John Sengstack's younger brother Frederick, is posted outside of a board meeting with a revolver. To kind of guard against any last minute intrusion that might upset what was becoming a transfer of ownership back to John Sengstack. I call it kind of an entertaining moment because Fred Sengstack, the younger brother of John, says that the particular revolver involved most likely it was in terrible condition, and he doesn't imagine that it would have fired if he had actually been called to use it. It was really there just for show. But it was an incident in which there was some drama in the transfer of ownership there.
So John Sengstack, in his own right, arguably as influential as Robert Abbott, had been during the kind of first phase or first couple of phases of the Defenders' growth. And one of his kind of his most important interventions is right near the start of his reign, when he helps to found the National Newspaper Publishers Association. How important was that in terms of attempting to unify the black press in the United States, and how significant was it that it was Sengstack and the Defender that was at the heart of the association?
It's a great question. The black press was composed, of course, of individual newspapers who were rivals for readers nationally. The Defender for many years, the largest competitor of the Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, definitely tried to become a national newspaper that had that would try to get the same readers as the Defender. It would actively try to poach the readers, as well as writers and columnists and stories. They were all competitors in that way, and yet they were, of course, together when it came to various causes, both political causes such as overtly or kind of general political causes such as integrating the U.S. armed forces or generally defeating legal segregation in the United States, as well as more economic causes such as opening up large advertisers and forcing them or influencing them or persuading them to advertise in African American owned publications, which they never did and still don't today, to numbers that would be equivalent to what they do in white owned publications. So they never, white owned corporations or large publicly owned corporations still do not advertise in African American publications to the extent that they do in white owned publications with similar readerships. But that was something that that all of the members of the black press had in common as a need. So Robert Abbott had dreamed of bringing together the black press along these lines, but had never been able to accomplish it in his lifetime. There's something quite poignant that John Sengstack was able to convene the first meeting of the NNPA on the day that Robert Abbott died. So there really was this sense that he was, his spirit was kind of bringing together all of these publishers who could unite And if with Robert Abbott had still been alive, they would certainly would have called him horrible names and abused his reputation. But in death, they were able to come together and reflect on everything that he had done for all of them together. Because again, he was someone who had introduced modern newspaper techniques to the black press, and someone who introduced black readers to the idea that newspapers could be something around which they could rally, something that could be both a part of the mission for civil rights, or the struggle for civil rights, as well as something that would simply offer African Americans a chance to communicate, very much the way that social media, say, functions today. And providing African Americans with recognition for all of the quotidian events and accomplishments which were ignored by the rest of the media, the birthdays and promotions and accomplishments of just a kind of regular nature. Sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I was just going to ask, kind of following up from that, and another signature contribution of Sendstack was his decision to transition The Defender from a weekly publication in the mid-1950s into a daily publication. It's kind of a very bold move. Was that, in your opinion, influenced by kind of the developing post-World War II civil rights movement? Was that a response to perhaps increasing competition within Chicago from kind of Johnson Publishing Company or other black publishing firms on either a local or a national scale? What were the reasons behind Sendstack's decision to transfer to a daily format?
Well, at that time, Sendstack was really the dominant player when it came to news from providing news to an African American readership. He had, by that moment in time, defeated his newspaper rivals for African American readers. The Pittsburgh Courier was no longer its longtime publisher had passed away. And it's without him, the leadership really the newspaper kind of fizzled in terms of its ability to get attention, and other rivals had likewise kind of faded from the scene. But as you point out, the Ebony Jet was an enormous had become an enormously profitable media enterprise by providing African-American readers with something new, photographs and lifestyle articles and other kinds of news that color photographs in particular that were showing readers that there were alternatives. With the civil rights movement, however, something else happened, which is that white-owned newspapers discovered first the importance of African-American issues, and very soon thereafter, the importance of African-American journalists as well as readers. Once they realized that African-American readers could generate numbers both in terms of increasing circulation and in terms of response to advertising, white-owned publications were very happy to try to grab up those African-American readers who were really just a new territory for them. Well, to reach those African-American readers and increasingly to report on issues within the African-American community, they also started to need African-American reporters. So this was a little bit, this was still on the horizon. All this was still on the horizon in 1955, but Sengstack could see it coming. And he knew that he was going to have to modernize his newspaper empire, which included The Defender as well as a number of other publications, if he was going to remain relevant and stay competitive. So he built a new facility for the newspaper and made it go daily so that they could compete on a day-to-day basis at first on coverage of the civil rights movement. And they did do that very successfully. They were ahead of the white-owned press when it came to discovering Martin Luther King, who I think the Defender helped keep alive in those early days of the Montgomery bus boycott, when the Defender was the only national media outlet covering him. And then suddenly with the arrival of other white-owned publications, Martin Luther King was a national figure who was then could not be touched by the would-be lynchers of the South, at least not for a few years. So there was both a political angle and an economic angle to the shift to becoming a daily. I'll stop there and I'll let you follow up if you'd like.
Well, I was going to follow up just in terms of seeing this as a kind of double-edged sword with regards to mainstream or white press move towards kind of more extensive coverage of the civil rights movement, and then also this kind of siphoning of black journalists out of black press or black publishing institutions. What kind of effect does this have on the Defender's own circulation, particularly kind of towards the late 60s and then into the 1970s?
Well, circulation is impacted a little bit, but this was a question I really had to wrestle with, frankly, as a former staff member who had always talked in the newsroom along with my peers and said, oh, if only the owners, the cheap owners would do this and do this and do this, we'd be competitive with the Tribune and the sometimes the big daily newspapers in town. And as I was doing my research, I came across that same conversation happening in every era of the newspaper, going back as far as I could reconstruct conversations in the newsroom. So as far back as the 1920s, people would say, "Oh, if only Mr. Abbott would do this and this and this, we could compete with the Tribune." And then it was the Daily News. And I had to understand, as I looked at the circulation numbers, which never really were in that ballpark, in that range of those large daily newspapers, right? The Defender, when it became a daily, ranged from a high of around 50,000 a day to somewhere around 25, 30,000 a day when I worked there in the 1990s, right? So it never really went up that high. And at the same time, it never dropped down to the level where it was unsustainable either. And that was very important, very significant for the longevity and the sustainability, actually, of the newspaper as an enterprise. At the same time, it was never more or less than a voice of conscience in the city. In other words, the Defender was never intended, I realize now in retrospect, nor did it could it be more or less than a voice of conscience. It has to have a kind of a broadcast at a very specific frequency. And in that regard, when you read the Defender in the 1920s and compare, if you read, for example, the Chicago Tribune in the 1920s, you cringe as a modern person because of the level of racism and sexism and xenophobia that are just a regular part of written language at that particular moment, right? But if you read the Defender at that time, it sounds modern because the Defender was opposed to all of those tendencies. And so in that respect, the newspaper never really wavered that much in terms of its circulation. That said, what your question suggests is absolutely correct, which is that the Defender had to constantly adapt in a reality in which its writers could constantly be attracted by the Sun-Times or the Tribune, or increasingly by television and radio stations, which were trying to get African-American journalists. So the Defender, John Sengstack complained at one moment, became a training ground for those publications. And eventually the Defender could offer couldn't even offer young African-American journalists a training ground as the Tribune and the Sun-Times and television stations became increasingly hungry for African-American talent. They would get folks right out of college and wouldn't wait for them to spend a few years in the black press. So the black press in that respect suffered from having less candidates. But at the same time, you have to remember that there were no journalism schools when Robert Abbott was starting out. He had to home grow his own journalists. He had to take Pullman porters and bellhops and factory workers and make them into journalists. And so this was a very different operation in every way from what the Defender was in its early days, with the consistent nature of the newspaper being that it was this voice of conscience throughout its different eras.
Just following on from that, one of the things I actually enjoyed most about your book is that it kind of helps to push back a bit, or certainly complicate that kind of well-established narrative of black press decline kind of particularly post 1970. And you kind of focus more on the Defender's continued relevance and importance and significance, particularly in relation to political figures such as Harold Washington in the 1980s. To what extent is Chicago still seen or can still be viewed as that kind of capital of black politics into the 1980s, and what role does the Defender play in that?
Well, in the 1980s, Chicago plays very much a role as that it had played throughout its history, in the sense that it is still this garrison of resistance that Frederick Douglass had envisioned Chicago to be back even as far as the 1890s. Now, the 1890s were, like the 1980s, an era in which rights were being rolled back. This is the era in which Ronald Reagan, reigning in the White House, Ronald Reagan, of course, had launched his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the site of the murder of three civil rights workers not too many years earlier. The message there was unmistakable. This is going to be, if I can make an inference from today's politics, we are going to make America great again. This was not a message they were not talking about restoring African American rights to when they were fully enjoyed. They were talking about rolling back African. Ronald Reagan was talking about rolling back African American rights. Harold Washington was part of that resistance in the Congress. He very much enjoyed being part of the Democratic majority then in the House of Representatives, which was able to be a bulwark against Ronald Reagan. And to a certain extent, what attracted him to coming back to Chicago and becoming mayor was to fight back in a city with the whole city behind him. Against the so-called Reagan Revolution. There's a moment in which Harold Washington is the Department of Housing and Urban Development is trying to take over Chicago's public housing system. And Harold Washington very dramatically came out and said, not HUD, which is the abbreviation for the department, not HUD nor MUD nor anyone else is going to take over my city's housing authority. And it's that kind of resistance to a reactionary white supremacy that is taking place that is very much part of what's going on in Chicago in the 1980s. And the Defender is very much aware of this tradition. The Defender and John Sengstack are there in what had become Harold Washington's campaign had, of course, become this horribly racist contest in which white people who had been Democrats for generations instantly became Republicans when the nominee was an African American. And that kind of stark racial divide, the Defender called out even as newspapers like the Tribune became somewhat muddled and a little confused in their analysis of this situation, it was the Defender that was again this voice of conscience that called out what was happening. And it's very much what was happening in the 1980s that inspired a new generation of African American political leaders, in particular a young activist on the South Side, a young, brash, he would say audacious activist on the South Side named Barack Obama, who comes to Chicago during the Harold Washington years because it's this garrison of resistance, and tries to impress the Harold Washington administration with his great intellect and ability, and somewhat rebuffed in his efforts to join the administration. But eventually, after he goes to law school, which he's inspired to do to beef up his credentials, when he comes back to Chicago, it's to put political roots down in a place where he recognizes the infrastructure for African American political achievement is in place. Chicago and African American politics in Chicago in particular are the only place that could have launched Barack Obama to the presidency. Not New York, not Hawaii, nowhere else where he might have settled could have provided him with the political apparatus that allowed him to go to the presidency. The Billiken parade provides him with an early stamp of legitimacy. Well, even earlier than that, Barack Obama's first political parade Billiken parade as a state senator provided him with a full appreciation of how large, savvy and sophisticated the African American electorate in the city was as he marched down King Drive for that first parade, surrounded by a very small entourage in this election, or in that particular parade. Barack Obama then, for the first time, understood just how this parade and this institution as a parade would help him. And it was that first parade was the last one in which he marched without an immense entourage. And he, a few years later, worked very hard to get himself named Grand Marshal of the Billiken Parade, again, to secure that legitimacy, that stamp of approval from this all-important African-American constituency. I would argue that even this year, in this election, it was the African-American electorate on the South Side of Chicago that rebuffed Bernie Sanders' campaign and gave Hillary Clinton that stamp of approval that is putting her on the path to definitely put her on the path to get the Democratic nomination and put her on the shape to compete for the presidency.
We're running short of time, unfortunately, yeah. But that seems like a good place to draw it to a close. Just before you go, Ita, if you'd like to tell any of our listeners projects that you might be working on of interest at the moment, or if you have an online presence, if they can follow your work elsewhere.
The easiest way to get me online is through either Twitter or Facebook. As long as you are an actual person, I will friend you on Facebook. It's just my name in normal spelling on both Twitter and Facebook, and I'm again can be reachable at either of those social media sites. Next project, I'll be working on another book that will look at race and history as they intersect internationally. I won't go into too much detail now, just because the project hasn't sold, so there's no guarantee that it will actually happen until then.
That's great. Thanks so much for joining me today, Ita. Ita Mikhaeli's book, The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America, is available at all good bookshops now. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in African American Studies, part of the New Books Network. Support for the network is generously provided by Amherst College Press. For more information, go to newbooksnetwork.com, where you can subscribe via iTunes, or follow on Facebook and Twitter. Goodbye.